This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
All right. Everybody drinks on me, okay? What do you have?
That's James Franco playing a bartender, serving a clientele of pimps, prostitutes, cops, criminals, and businessmen in the new HBO series The Deuce. My guests are the series creators, David Simon, who also created The Wire and co-created Tremé, and George Pelicanos, a crime novelist who wrote for both series. The Deuce is set in Times Square beginning in 1971, before Disney moved in, when 42nd Street was a center of prostitution, adult bookstores, peep shows, and movie theaters. The series follows the pimps and prostitutes who work the streets, the cops who patrol them, the mob that's trying to expand there, and the city government leaders who are trying to figure out what to do about Times Square. The characters don't know it yet, but the porn industry is about to take off and become a big business. James Franco stars in two roles, Vincent the bartender and his ne'er-do-well identical twin brother Frankie, who's gambled away his money and is in debt to the mob. Maggie Gyllenhaal plays a prostitute who has always refused to work with a pimp and is hoping to get out of the trade by learning to make porn films. David Simon, George Pelicanos, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on The Deuce. So lots of people know the Disney version of Times Square, the current version of Times Square. Remind us what it was like in 1971, the year when The Deuce begins.
We start in 1971 on this show, and at that point, the middle of Manhattan, the Midtown area, was really given over to a lot of vice. It was, of course, the theater district, but that was coexisting with a lot of depressed real estate, a lot of prostitution, some street drug trafficking. It had become a New York that seemed to be failing in some very basic ways.
Two of the main characters in The Deuce are identical twins, both played by James Franco. Vincent runs a bar that caters to a lot of cops and sex workers, and his brother is a gambler and, someone who's always getting into trouble. They're based on two real identical twins who I think you met, or at least you met one of them?
Well, we met the character whose name is Vincent on the show, the bar owner. And his brother had passed, and he actually passed away before we shot the pilot. But David and I spent a good deal of time with him. And it was his stories and his delivery in a way that got us interested to begin with. You know, we didn't particularly want to do a show about pornography, and we almost grudgingly took the meeting with this guy. But after we spoke to him, the story started to come alive for us because he knew so many people. Their arcs were so defined. And this bar that he had was an unusual place for that time because, you know, at the time you had segregated bars. You had the gay bars downtown. You had black bars, white bars, that kind of thing. He welcomed everybody into this place. So he knew prostitutes, pimps, porn actors, politicians, journalists, gay and straight, transgender. And he was the kind of guy that, although he was complicit in a lot of the things that we're going to get to on the show, he had a live and let live attitude. And the fact that he had a brother that was sort of not a bad guy, but he dragged him into a lot of bad situations, created conflict, which was, you know, natural for drama for us.
So you like this guy?
I would say I like a good bit of him, yeah.
Right. Fair
enough. He's problematic. He was problematic in certain ways, but there was a lot of charm to him, I will say. But then, you know, at the same time, there were moments where, you know, he would tell us a story about somebody and we would say, well, what happened to her? And you know, the answer was never that she married a podiatrist and moved to Scarsdale and had three kids. It was always, the vast majority of the stories were attritive. And so you started to get that vibe as well.
So the series is also about pornography and how pornography is changing. And I want to play a short clip here. There's a scene where one of the prostitutes, Darlene, finds out that one of her Johns has not only made a film of them having sex, but he sold it, and it's being sold under the counter at the local bookstore that has a lot of porn that it sells under the counter. And so she goes in to try to get her hands on one of these films and find out who's making money off of her surreptitiously like this. So here's Dominique Fishback as Darlene and E.J. Carroll as the bookstore owner.
Hey, Moon.
Darling, what's your name?
In a movie of myself. I heard you running in the machine over there.
Could be, I don't know.
And I'm guessing you got copies people can buy, too.
I'll have to check the inventory.
Do that.
I only have two left. You're very popular.
Backdoor Betty. How much you sell these for?
50 to Chumps, 35 the regulars. Why?
Where do they come from? Who puts them out?
Oh.
What are you, an owl? Whose movie is it?
Darling, what do you want, an address? I don't know.
You don't know.
It may have heard, but it's illegal to have sex for money. And it's illegal to sell pictures of people having sex for money. I mean, cheesecake, you know, okay. But the hardcore stuff stays in paper bags. I can't even put it out in the store. So, ooh, not a sensible question for me.
Where do you get them from?
I get them. Take them, you want. I don't care. Go. Go.
Buy one back for me, $10.
Jesus.
The least you can do.
Oh, I'm just listening to the sound of the cash register. the ringing and the drawer closing. And
it's that's anachronism, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that guy's voice, the guy who's the bookstore owner.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah. Anyway, so tell us what the laws were at the time. Like, he's talking about how it's not only illegal to sell sex, it's illegal to show people selling sex. What are the porn laws at the time, 1971?
Well, you couldn't show penetration, basically, was the big one.
Mm-hmm. So
even the machines, when you went into these places, they were supposed to be edited so that that was not being shown. And the movies that were out, you know, it was almost okay if it was a foreign film and it was under the guise of a documentary like Sex USA or, you know, before that it was I Am Curious Yellow and all these Swedish films. But if it was a narrative, if it was a story where you were showed people having sex, that was illegal. And then it busted out, you know. All of a sudden it became fine to show these things.
Did the laws change?
Not really. This was sort of an ambiguous period. And to hear the people who were involved in pornography tell it, it was kind of like, we'll push a little further. We'll push the envelope back a little further. We'll see if this flies, if that flies. One of the big moments, I think, for New York was, it was actually a gay film called Boys in the Sand, which we make reference to and we actually show a clip of in the piece, which is, there was a hardcore gay film made on Fire Island in 70, I think it was, exhibited in 71, and it played in an art house, and for whatever reason, it was, I guess because, you know, they had Ravel and some other composers. I mean, it was sort of, you know, it kind of was artfully filmed, despite the hardcore content. It managed to sustain itself in a regular theater for 8, 9, 10 months in New York. And anybody who was at the edge of the skin trade sort of looked up and said, how are they not getting rated? And it was one of those first moments of, man, nobody can really tell the difference between what's obscene and what isn't anymore. It's not the old adage, the old Supreme Court adage of we know it when we see it. And so once that became an open-ended debate, a lot of judges, a lot of Superior Court judges in New York were not going to sentence you for an obscenity case anymore. And once that happened, it fell to the community standard logic. And of course, places like New York and San Francisco had much more lax standards for what they were willing to tolerate than other places.
And that also brings up an interesting point about the nature of the content. At this point in time, people, filmmakers, pornographers, actually had artistic aspirations. They wanted to make good porn movies. And so you had films like a little bit later, Behind the Green Door and Devil Miss Jones, and this was after Deep Throat. And, of course, the funny thing is now is that we've reverted back to the roots of pornography, meaning if you get on your laptop and look at porn, it's basically 10-minute loops that go right to the money shot. They've given up on any aspirations for art, but it went backwards.
Well, you don't need that to justify it anymore.
I don't think so, no.
Not at
I think
all.
People watching
not
at home, all. They just want to kind of get to the point.
If they want a plot, they'll watch the news. It became a vehicle
for sexual release. I mean, that moment of porn chic when some of the people making the films had this one window of believing that they were on the way to creating some new genre of cinematic genre. It was a very brief moment. And you could probably time the end of it to the arrival of VHS, of videotape, because at that point, the entire physical plant of places like the Deuce or North Beach in San Francisco, it became irrelevant. You didn't, you know, the raincoat crowd was no longer the audience. The audience was the American people, and by and large, the American male, and it was going to his living room.
So the Maggie Gyllenhaal character is like the only prostitute in the series, the only sex worker in the series who refuses to work with a pimp. If someone's going to pay for her services, she's going to get all the money. She's not going to give some of it to a pimp. She fills in for a woman in a porn shoot, and she gets very interested in how is this put together. The film that she's making, you know, that she's appearing in, this porn short, it's such a ridiculous film. It's like the women have blonde braids and they're kissing each other, and then naked Vikings walk in. So the naked guys walk in with Viking helmets and horns coming out of the helmets.
It is called Great Dane in the Morning.
Yes, porn always has great titles. So anyways, did you watch a lot of porn films of the era? And were they mostly as ridiculous as the one that you have in The Deuce? Not that I intend to put you on the spot.
We're looking at each other. And,
who's going to take this answer first?
Are we going to admit on NPR that we had to buy a first rate pornograph and put it in the middle of the office? And we looked at what we were depicting, to be certain. And I mean, to be honest with you, I think we were about 11 and 12 in 1971. But by the late 70s, when New York was sort of at the height of this stuff, George and I were teenagers. We're American men. We probably have acquired a certain amount of pornography, I think it's safe to say. So we're aware of what we're depicting, even what we're remarking on at points in the show, of course. But yeah, I think the point that we were trying to make in that first moment in the second episode was that Maggie's character of Candy is encountering the basement variety of how loops were made before even what they called the one-a-day wonders.
This is language a lot of people won't be familiar with. Loops, one-day wonders.
It's a guy shoot minimal props. He's shooting it in his basement in the Bronx. He doesn't even have sound. He's not running sound.
Mm-hmm.
It is as close to like an 8mm home movie as you could. You know, he's got a little bit of lighting, but he's using an 8mm camera, and he's you know, you had to develop it either in your own bathroom where you were using a mob run lab that used to put these things out. But these are not feature films. These are not anything that was intended to go anywhere but into a home projection camera or into a peep show. And that was sort of the prime logic of pornography until it was able to come out of the shadows.
And you can tell the women in this short film are faking it. They're not even, they don't even know how to make it look real, if you know what I mean. It looks just like, so everybody's going through the motions. So when you were young and watching things like that, and you could tell this is like a really cheap, badly made production, everybody's faking it, but still they're naked and engaged in sex. As artists yourselves, you know, did you have this kind of disconnect between like the quality of the film and the sensations it was arousing in you?
Terry, when I was 11 years old in 1971, I was trying to steal my dad's Playboy and figure out like what was going on. So I have to say, at a certain point, the idea that I was looking in any way at pornography in any kind of, you know, I was on the way even in high school to being a newspaper reporter. George was going to be a novelist. So I don't think we were looking at any of this stuff cinematically. We were just trying to figure out the mysteries of what we didn't know. You know, I mean, I think in retrospect, now looking back on what pornography has become in American life, how ubiquitous it is, and what is at a 10 or 12 or 14-year-old kid's fingertips now on the internet, that's interesting to me. The idea of how blunt and how, frankly, misogynistic a certain portion of that pornography is and how available it is. Because it was all, whether it was pornographic or erotic or anything, it was all weirdly forbidden, if that's a word, when I was a teenager. It was, you know, I mean, I don't think I saw that, George, I'm speaking for myself, but I don't think I saw a porn loop until I was 18 or 19. You know, I had to be of age to walk into a dirty bookstore.
That's right.
Your turn,
that's
George.
Right. Give it up, George.
You know, it wasn't a big part of my life, I can tell you that. I mean, we had theaters in D.C. I'd go down there with buddies of mine occasionally and check it out, but you knew what it was. I mean, it was, you weren't looking for production values. And that's pretty much the case of all the exploitation movies I used to see, and, you know, the karate films, blaxploitation. You know, it was another way to have fun.
Grindhouse. Yeah,
Grindhouse. I mean, but I didn't think about it that much, and I sure didn't think about, you know, in the back of my mind, I might have thought, well, that's somebody's daughter or that's somebody's sister, you know. But that was the extent of my, you know, my self-reflection.
So you're working in difficult territory in making The Deuce Beat, because it's a series about women being sexually exploited by
Absolutely.
Their pimps, by the Johns who pay for them, by the cops.
By the pornographers.
And by the pornographers. So, like, you're in the position of making a series about women who are sexually exploited. You're going to be showing them naked. You're going to be showing them having sex. How do you do that without continuing to exploit the actresses playing the exploited women?
Well, David and I worked on this for 2 or 3 years before we shot any film. And it was continually on our minds, how were we going to approach it. And it went from conception to shooting to the editing room. You know, and sometimes we'd be in the editing room and we'd say, you know, the camera's lingering on her breasts. Let's take 5 seconds out of that. But the other thing is that also that we did that I think was very helpful was that we surrounded ourselves with a lot of women on the creative side. And so the writer's room is has women, you know, very good female novelists that we have, Megan Abbott, Lisa Lutz. Michelle McLaren directed the pilot and the last episode. In fact, half of our directors were women in an industry where it's, I think the figure is 15%. And many of the department heads and our creative partner, Nina Noble, who's been with David's for, you know, 20 years, was there with us every step of the way, keeping us honest, as were all these other people.
Can you give us an example of one of the discussions or debates you had about how to handle a certain scene or what to show and what not to show?
Well, this might give more insight. You know, when we have these things called tone meetings, when a director would come for an episode, and of course there would be sexually explicit scenes in every episode because, as you point out, that's what it's about. This is about sexual commodification and the misuse, the use and misuse of women. So we would get to these scenes, and the one thing that we kept telling them was, the camera, I'm much more interested. I used to use this. I said, okay, you've got some scenes on a porn set. I'm much more interested in a moment where the food run comes and the sandwiches come for everybody and they're standing around dividing up the sandwiches than I am in the moment where the camera is recording people having sex. That doesn't mean that there aren't moments where we have to, for purposes of story, depict the sexual activity. And it doesn't mean we're trying to avoid anything. It's trying to make all the moments neutral, that there's as much character development in what happens between the shots as there is in the actual sexuality you're depicting. At the same time, and this is really important, I think, is you're trying not to have the camera linger, as George says. You're trying to restrict the camera's use as a titillating agent, as an exploitive agent. And so you're being really rigorous about what you're not trying to light to make it more erotic or more pornographic. You're not trying to capture pornographic tableaus. You're chasing other things with the camera. But the other thing that you cannot do is you can't merely allude to what pornography is. Because if you do that, if you start getting, you don't want to be prurient, but if you're Puritan as well, now you're saying something else. Now you're cleaning it up. Now you're taking what is pornography and what its uses and purposes and intent is, and you're making it into some off-screen joke. It becomes lighthearted. Yeah, you're on your way to making Pretty Woman. And in some ways, if you're going to do a piece that is explicitly about the sexual commodification of women, that that's what it's about, then you have to show what that is. And you have to show what it is and be direct about the fact that that is a very coarse product and a very painful.
The clothing is so 70s. And one thing I have to say about the clothing, and I don't mean to sound old-fashioned or anything, but I'll just come out and say it. I was noticing Saturday night as I was walking down a street with a lot of clubs on it that all the young women were dressed as if they were in the Deuce, as if they were like the prostitutes on the Deuce, with the very short shorts and the midriff tops. I don't mean to sound like prudish or old-fashioned, but like that kind of clothing is just what people wear now. You wouldn't see somebody wearing that and go like, oh, they must be a prostitute, as you might have in 1971.
And that's something we also hope to address both subliminally, and I think there may be points where it actually can, we can actually reference it, but I think mostly you're going to have to get it, you know, looking in retrospective from today's world, which is this, that porn itself, even beyond the actual pornography, even beyond the actual dirty movies and the dirty pictures, it changed the way we look at ourselves, the way men look at women, the way women respond to the reality of what's in, you know, men's brains at this point. We don't sell anything without using the tropes of pornography. We don't sell beer or cars or blue jeans without in some way referencing a lot of what has become normalized imagery and normalized culture through the ubiquity of pornography over the last 50 years. It's been a long time. It's been half a century that this stuff has been in the ether. And you know, in the same way that early pornography certainly took a lot of its tropes from mainstream film and played with them, it's gone the other way. And now, I mean, I think, you know, for everything from fashion to music, to regular cinema, the pornographication of America has been profound. I mean, you don't have a multi-billion-dollar industry operating every year and not have it transform the way we think about ourselves and each other. And I don't think anyone's got a good handle on the depth of that. I think it's happened so fast and it's been so unexamined, so without any, I don't think anyone's examined it with any degree of seriousness, that I'm not sure we know what we've built.
David Simon and George Pelikanos, thank you so much and congratulations on the series.
Thank you.
David Simon and George Pelikanos created the new HBO series, The Deuce. In July, I interviewed Haroon Mogal after the publication of his memoir, How to Be a Muslim, An American Story. Mogal is a first-generation American whose parents are from Pakistan. We invited him back, this time to read an essay he wrote for us about the time a seemingly minor encounter at a border crossing turned his life around.
She'd been the love of my life. We were together for a dozen years, and then it was over. I was 32, bipolar, and divorce felt like the end of the world. I was so depressed, I was hospitalized. Friends told me I needed time away to begin to heal. They helped me move to Dubai where I could be with family. But weeks passed, and I hardly recovered. I was no longer suicidal, it's true, but I didn't really care if I was alive either. Loved ones insisted that I should keep living until one day I'd want to. So every 40 days I'd drive to the nearest international border, leave Dubai, promptly make a U-turn, and come back in. I'd get a new tourist visa and another 40 days to find a reason to live. I was always nervous on these journeys. In the year since my passport picture had been taken, I'd lost 60 pounds. I hardly looked like myself, and each time I approached a border, I feared I'd be denied a visa or, worse, deported. On just one such trip, everything was going deceptively smoothly. I pulled up to a police officer, sitting on what looked like a lawn chair, outside what looked like a toll booth. He wore gold-rimmed Ray-Bans, as all uniformed agents of Arab nations should. He appeared not to have a care in the world. Of course, when I handed over my passport, he flipped to the photograph page and burst out laughing. That seemed to be it, though. He wordlessly stamped my passport and waved me forward. But I was not 15 minutes into the drive back that the car behind me, license plates from Oman, flashed its headlights. The driver gestured for me to pull over. Maybe in the desert wild he intended to kidnap, kill, or eat me. But maybe he just needed help. Car trouble out here could mean death. We both pulled into the breakdown lane and exited our cars. But as I walked towards him, he started backing up, like he was scared of me. Keeping his distance, he said, "You go back." "Go back?" I asked. "Police say you go back," he explained. Then he dove into his car and rocketed away. Was this some kind of gambit to steal my car and leave me stranded? But fearing I might be arrested otherwise, I returned to the same toll booth, and the same officer regarded me with great confusion. And then he smiled, remembering why he'd called me back. He yelled, "Muhammad!" Another officer, presumably Muhammad, rushed over. "Show him," the toll booth officer ordered, "your passport." My jaw all but fell to the floor. The officer had deputized a citizen of another country just to show his friend my fat picture? Before I could say anything, he snatched my passport and opened the picture page for Muhammad. "You were so fat," he cried. Muhammad laughed, but then turned deadly serious. "How?" Muhammad asked with genuine curiosity. "Did you lose so much weight?" What was I going to say? That the doctor's best guess was that I had an autoimmune disorder? That I lost my job, my savings, my apartment, my wife, my reasons to go on living? That I hardly cared how I looked or if I ate? Instead, I did the Muslim equivalent of throwing my hands in the air. "Alhamdulillah," I said. The Arabic means, simply, "praise the Lord." But I'd whispered it, lending the moment a sacred aura I'd not intended. In Dubai, they suffer first-world problems, but they process them with 7th-century spirituality. "Alhamdulillah," the officers repeated, transformed, like they'd never laughed at me at all. We might have come from different ends of the earth, but in that brief moment, we became one. And then the encounter was over. On the drive back, I suddenly burst out laughing. I hadn't laughed that hard since my divorce. I didn't think I ever would. But the whole thing was so ridiculous. I knew then that I'd tell everyone what had happened. I'd pass my passport around, too, for dramatic effect. And then it hit me. Alongside the pain of the past and the numbness of the present, there was something else. I knew I wanted to stick around long enough to tell this story.
Haroon Mogal is the author of the memoir, How to Be a Muslim, An American Story, and a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute. Thank you. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Litt, wrote jokes for President Obama like this one.
A few weeks ago, Dick Cheney says he thinks I'm the worst president of his lifetime. Which is interesting because I think Dick Cheney is the worst president of my lifetime.
That was President Obama doing stand-up at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner, one of the four White House Correspondents' Dinners for which David Litt served as Obama's lead writer. After he started out in 2011 as the guy on the speechwriting team who was assigned the speeches no one else wanted to write, Litt became a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter. He's written a new memoir called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. Before writing speeches, Litt wrote for the satirical newspaper The Onion. While he was still in college, he worked as a volunteer on Obama's first presidential campaign. Litt is now the head writer, producer at Funnier Die's Washington, D.C. office. David Litt, welcome to Fresh Air. Since you worked on several of the White House Correspondents' Dinners, and since Obama was always so funny at those dinners, let's start there. First of all, tell us a couple of your best jokes that you wrote for Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinners.
Well, for me, my favorite jokes were always the ones that he personally enjoyed. So one I write about is the 2013 dinner. This was an earlier time when Republicans felt that they needed to do a better job of reaching beyond their base. And President Obama said, one thing all Republicans can agree on is they need to do a better job reaching out to minorities. Call me self-centered, but I can think of one minority they could start with. And I love that joke because it was the first time, to my knowledge, President Obama ever referred to himself as a minority in public. So it was an example of where we got to go a little further with the jokes than you could otherwise go. And it was also just one that he enjoyed a lot. I mean, I could always tell if he really liked a joke, he'd add his own spin on it. He'd sort of tag it. And with that joke, he said, oh, you know, that's pretty good. I might add a little wave in there, like a hello. And in the actual performance, he also added the line, think of me as a trial run, which I thought was pretty funny.
Why wouldn't he have referred to himself as a minority before agreeing to do that joke?
Well, this was the beginning of the second term. And in the first term, I think there was still concern about exactly how far we wanted to go. I mean, everybody knew that President Obama was the first African-American president. He'd already spoken many, many times very eloquently about race, but publicly identifying himself in that way was still something that prior to the 2012 election, we would have been skittish about, I think, in a joke. As an example, in the 2012 election, we had thought about asking Keegan-Michael Key to come on as Luther the Anger Translator because President Obama was a big fan of Key and Peele. I think the show had just started then, and I remember there was sort of a general sense of that would be really funny, but do we really want to suggest that President Obama is secretly an angry black man? Probably not.
So let me ask you to explain for people who never saw this Key and Peele sketch and never saw Obama's White House Correspondents' Dinner takeoff on it, who is Luther Obama's anger translator?
So Luther the Anger Translator was a character that Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele from their Comedy Central show came up with their writers. And the idea was that Jordan Peele would play the president and he would be very composed and calm and both about race, but also about all of the other elements, all this other craziness that people put Obama through. And Keegan-Michael Key would be his translator because President Obama couldn't show anger in his actual life. So he would be there to rant and rave about whatever Obama was really thinking. And perhaps unsurprisingly, President Obama liked this character a lot. And that year, we had thought about it, and we thought about it every year until 2015 when we could finally do it. It was one of those things where we always imagined, wouldn't it be fun to have President Obama as the President Obama character and have Luther the Anger Translator there with him to translate? But it never felt quite right for a variety of reasons. And then in 2015, to me, it was the thing that was indicative of the shift in tone that we had after the midterms. We all said, oh, yeah, this makes total sense.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of how that sounded? So this is the Luther Obama's anger translator sketch at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
You know, I often joke about tensions between me and the press, but honestly, what they say doesn't bother me. I understand we've got an adversarial system. I'm a mellow sort of guy. And that's why I invited Luther, my anger translator, to join me here tonight. Hold on to your lily white butts. In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? And why am I required to come to it? Jeb Bush, do you really want to do this?
Because despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense. Sharia law is coming to Cleveland. Run for the damn hills.
So that was President Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner with Luther, his anger translator, played by Keegan-Michael Key. And my guest is David Litt, who wrote jokes for President Obama and was one of his speechwriters, and now has a memoir called Thanks, Obama. You know, the White House Correspondents' Dinners basically have become roasts, and the jokes are pretty cutting. So was there a ground rule for how cutting a joke could be and when did it cross the line to actually be, to go too far, to be too offensive to the person who was being satirized?
I think the jokes that President Obama told, and it's not like there was a memo written, but there was just a sense of who the president is and what he would feel comfortable with. The jokes were always trying to make sure that we were getting at some truth that was important. And also, if we were kind of targeting someone with a joke, that it was someone who deserved it. And in a way in that they deserved it. I mean, every year we would get pitched jokes, and this was totally fine. It's everyone's job to pitch everything that they think of. But you'd get jokes making fun of, let's say, Chris Christie's size. And we never would use that in a speech because that's not the thing about Governor Chris Christie that is worthy of mockery. And that sort of thing, where we would make sure that it was about the political, not about the personal, I think was important. I will say that President Obama was often the one pushing us to, his words were, can we make this sharper? Can we make this edgier?
So what was your reaction when President Trump declined to attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner this year?
I was not surprised that he didn't go because I had watched him at the Al Smith Dinner, which is kind of the correspondence dinner of the presidential campaign, and he got booed during that dinner. And it is more or less impossible to get booed during a dinner like that. I mean, politeness is kind of the core virtue of a society like the Al Smith Dinner. And he still managed to do it. So I think he understood that it wasn't going to go well if he came. He does not have the ability to deliver the kind of jokes that presidents are supposed to and that people appreciate from their presidents. I was still disappointed that he didn't give it a shot and that he didn't try to sort of meet the standard that has been set, not in terms of comedy, but just in terms of self-deprecation, in terms of acknowledging that you're only human. You may be the president of the United States, but you're also just a person and you have flaws and you make mistakes. And there's a way of using those jokes to acknowledge them through comedy. And I think that is an important democratic tradition in its own way. And I wish that President Trump realized that and he was willing to participate in it. I'm sadly not surprised he was not.
So when you started writing for President Obama, you were basically just out of college? I mean, a year or two out of college, maybe?
Yeah, I was about 2 years out of college, maybe three. I graduated in 2008 and I started writing at the White House in 2011.
What did it feel like to be that young and inexperienced, trying to put words in the mouth of the President of the United States?
It felt totally surreal and completely terrifying. And that's one of the things that I wanted to let people know, because when I imagined a White House job, I figured you walk through the gates and suddenly you're a White House staffer. You must be completely perfect and flawless at what you're doing. And then I walked through the gates for the first time and realized I was not any better than I was 15 seconds ago when they let me in. And I wanted to be honest about that. I wanted to be honest about how scary it can be. And it's wonderful and amazing, but also totally terrifying. I remember the first time I met the president, he asked me a question and I literally blacked out. I don't know what I said to him because I was so afraid to meet this person who had had such an impact on my life already and also, by the way, was the president of the United States.
The question was, how's it going? I mean, it wasn't a hard question.
It was a hard question at the time.
It's the kind of question that you're supposed to say, fine, thank you. And you?
And it's totally possible I did. I couldn't tell you. I don't remember.
So when you're writing speeches for President Obama or writing jokes for him, it's not just a question of how the president is going to react. It's also a question of how the world is going to react and how the press is going to react. So I'd like to ask you to give an example of something pretty minor, really, but that ended up getting criticized. And this was, I think it was your very first speech that you wrote for the president. It was a Thanksgiving Day speech. So tell us
yes.
the story of that. And by the way, did you have to pardon a turkey in this speech? Is it one of those?
No, I somewhat shockingly managed to never do the turkey pardon. And I don't know how I managed to avoid that one. The turkey pardon speech was always, that was sort of the most pun-laden speech of the year because there's all these Thanksgiving puns. So in some ways it was fun and in some ways everyone, it was sort of, by definition, it was sort of a festival of dad jokes. But this was 2011. I was writing the Thanksgiving video address, which is not the most important presidential speech, not by a long shot, but it was my first video that I'd ever written for President Obama, and I treated this thing tremendously seriously, and I thought I had done it. I thought I had done the perfect job of capturing the spirit of Thanksgiving for America, and the problem was that I left out the word God, or the Almighty, and I will say in my defense, at one point during the video, President Obama talked about giving thanks for blessings. So it's not like he was, you know, these blessings were coming from somewhere. It's not like we hadn't mentioned the idea of the Almighty at all. But this was enough for Fox News to jump on it and start a controversy. And by the time dessert was served, I was with my family. And I remember, you know, everyone was excited for me when we started the meal. And then by the end, it was clear this was going to be a story because Fox ran a Obama leaves God out of Thanksgiving address story. The conservative media began to pick it up. And then the mainstream press, I use ABC News as an example, they didn't cover the omission of the Almighty in the speech because I think they would have agreed that was not a big deal. But they did cover the controversy. So they ran a separate story about the fact that Fox News had run a story and that conservatives were riled up about this issue. And so you watched as this thing, which wasn't really a story at all, but it was a very small omission, it gradually seeped into the news cycle. And I say that not because I am avoiding responsibility for it. One of the things I learned as a White House speechwriter is that your job as a speechwriter is not to just write good speeches. Your job is to keep in the back of your mind the fact that there's a whole industry of people trying to take your words out of context, and that's politics. And so you need to write something that where you read through it and you say, A, are we saying what we want to say? And B, can this under no circumstances be misconstrued to say something different? And those kind of dual responsibilities are one of the reasons writing for a president is so difficult.
Isn't Thanksgiving a secular holiday?
Not according to Fox News, it's not. It is true that George W. Bush left God and the Almighty out of, I think, 5 of his 8 Thanksgiving Day addresses. The Daily Show did a whole piece on this. But it was one of those ways that I think the rules were different for President Obama than they were for his predecessor or than they are for Donald Trump when it came to the right-wing press and the way, to some extent, the mainstream press, too. He was held to a different standard. And you can complain about that. We certainly did. I certainly did. But you also recognize that's reality and you have to meet that standard, even though it's not fair.
So say you've written a speech on overtime or infrastructure that the president has to deliver. How far in advance does he actually see the speech?
We would usually give a speech like that to the president just the night before because those would be issues he's already addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's language we would already have.
Language
with a
that
big
you had
speech,
because he told you, here's what I want to say, here's my talking points, write a speech?
Well, one of the interesting things about writing for a president is everything the president has ever said is transcribed. So when we're doing a speech about infrastructure, for example, I could look back at the last 5 speeches about infrastructure and say, okay, this is the thing this is the paragraph that has been the same in all five speeches, probably it should be in the sixth one as well. And then I would be trying to figure out what is different and special about this one. How can I add something about the location or the new policy we're announcing, or tell a story of a person in the audience that hasn't been told before? But those were add-ons. They were sort of a decoration rather than architecture of the speech. And President Obama would make edits to that, but generally speaking, he understood that these speeches are not ending up in the history books. He's got other things to do that were well more important. And so he would make small changes, but often, especially in the second term, he would just ad-lib something if he thought he had a better way of putting it. In the first term, because there's the danger of people taking your words out of context and putting them in a campaign ad, we were even more careful about making sure that what was written on the page was exactly precisely right. In the second term, he was a little more willing to edit on the fly.
What do you think so far of President Trump's speeches, and I'll include in this his inaugural address, with the most famous line from the address being, "This American carnage"?
Okay. there's just so much to unpack with President Trump speaking. When I think about President Trump's speeches, I honestly wish that my biggest concern was the rhetoric or the words that he's using. And it's impossible to get past the thoughts that he's conveying and the argument that he's making. And the line that you just used about American carnage is a perfect example. It seems to me that that's a departure from all previous presidents who have tried to be optimistic, who have tried to say, this is the best of what America can be. And Donald Trump, because of his style as a candidate, he needs you to believe that America is falling apart, because his argument is, I alone can fix it. And so at every moment, he is saying these things that are not at all in keeping of what we would think of as presidential. They're trying to make America seem worse than it actually is, rather than make us realize that America could be better than it's ever been before. And so it's not a speechwriting concern. It's not a matter of rhetoric. It's a matter of what this person is trying to express. And I find it, disturbing as a speechwriter, but even more disturbing just as an American.
Well, David Litt, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. This was great.
David Litt's new memoir about writing speeches for President Obama is called Thanks, Obama.